Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The cost of prescription drugs is top of mind across the country. Pharma-related bills are pending or have passed in more than 40 states, and efforts to lower prices are afoot at the federal level as well. University of California Hastings law professor Robin Feldman recently wrote about the issue in the Washington Post. We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Her forthcoming book is titled Drugs, Money, and Secret Handshakes, The Unstoppable Growth of Prescription Drug Prices. Robin Feldman joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Why the word unstoppable in that subtitle?
The entire pharmaceutical industry operates in a very strange way. Everyone has budgets. Everyone has limits. But that's not functioning in the pharmaceutical industry. Instead, we see remarkable and disturbing price hikes year after year. Well, competition is the backbone of the American economy, but we just don't see that with drugs. Instead, we've got a very strange system in which higher-priced drugs receive favorable treatment and patients are channeled towards more expensive medicines. It's Alice in Wonderland time in the drug world, and it's our money going down the rabbit hole.
Why is it that competition doesn't play the role in the pharma industry that it does in most everything else?
Well, at the center of our very strange system are pharmacy benefit managers. If you're hoping for a simple, intuitive name to help you figure out who's on first, the pharma industry will always disappoint you. But we have these PBMs who are secretive mill players, and they establish coverage levels for patients or help with that, and they negotiate with drug companies. And here's how it works. Drug companies give financial incentives to the PBM middle players as well as to doctors and hospitals, and the payments ensure that inexpensive drugs never gain any traction in the market.
The PBMs, a lot of times when I'm reading about them, I keep getting this feeling that they're connected to the drug companies.
Well, they aren't supposed to be, but in an odd sense, they're tied at the hip. The PBM system starts with a structure that looks healthy on the surface. Health plans pay their PBMs based on the extent of the discount that a PBM can negotiate with drug companies. So this should encourage the PBM to drive prices down. After all, wouldn't you bargain hard if your pay were tied to how much of a discount you could negotiate?
Mm-hmm.
But drug companies have found a clever strategy. They raise their prices sky high year after year. Then they give a rebate. The PBM can claim to have negotiated a great deal. PBM gets to pocket the rebate. It's a little like a department store raising prices right before a sale, so the discount looks more appealing.
I thought that you had a great analogy in your Washington Post piece. It was kind of the craft beer versus the Budweisers.
Sure. So the name of the game in this is volume. The more volume a drug company has with a particular middle player or hospital, the better deal it can offer as a temptation to exclude rival drugs. It's a little like Budweiser going to a bar owner with the following offer and saying, okay, at the end of the year, I'll pay you 50 cents a bottle if you've sold 40,000 bottles of Bud. But better yet, I'll make it $1 a bottle if you don't put any of that microbrewery's beer on the menu. Now, if the microbrewery starts out by selling a limited number of bottles, which any new company is going to, how would it ever compete? The little guy could never offer enough off the price of its few beers to compensate for the tens of thousands of dollars the bar owner would forego by rejecting Budweiser's offer. And some of these medicines are protected by either patents or by various Medicare regulations that require plans to offer the medicine. So it's a little like a company saying, you know, in addition to beer, bar owner, you've also got to supply vodka, and we're only going to allow one vodka manufacturer. So go ahead, negotiate the best you can.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our Wellness Wednesday program, and we're talking about the cost of prescription drugs and why they're so high. My guest is University of California Hastings Law Professor Robin Feldman. Her new book is coming out in March. It's titled Drugs, Money, and Secret Handshakes, The Unstoppable Growth of Prescription Drug Prices. We'll have a link to her recent Washington Post piece at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wrote that the rise in drug prices is outpacing all other aspects of healthcare spending, including nursing home costs, which I can relate to having an elderly parent. How have public health officials responded to this?
Public health officials, both at the federal and at the state level, are looking for solutions. Everyone has a budget. Everyone's got a limit. Nobody has unlimited spending, and that's true for government as well. This is one of the more interesting proposals is one that has come from Health and Human Services Secretary Azar recently. So Secretary Azar is suggesting a limited proposal about allowing Medicare plans to negotiate based on reference pricing in other countries. That makes a lot of sense to me. In other words, if I'm going to buy a car, I ought to be able to say to the car company, I see you're selling the same car one town over for less. That's as much as I'm willing to pay. Why can't the government be allowed to negotiate that way?
Mm-hmm.
We all do.
So why can't it?
One of our big problems is the Byzantine and incredibly complicated system we have for drug approvals and also for Medicare. Drug companies have become masters at manipulating that system in a way that helps them. One of the classic examples I like to use is with the patent system. Patents are supposed to last for a limited period of time, and then generics should come in and compete. But that's not what we're seeing. We see drug companies piling on new protections, patents and other types, one after another. I looked at all of the drugs on the market between 2005 to 2015, and what I found was that 78% of the drugs associated with new patents weren't new drugs coming on the market. They were existing drugs. It's just churn. So we are lavishing wonderfully expensive rewards on minor tweaks of existing drugs.
Okay, so they're getting a new patent because they've tweaked something, one of the ingredients.
Tweaked something or mix and match. I like to think it's minor tweaks and mix and match. So think of the medication Trexamet. It's a migraine medication that combines an old migraine medication and naproxen, as in the naproxen that you can buy. So if you buy those two separately, it'll cost you $1.50. Trexamet, which is just the two mixed together, costs about $100 per pill.
Where does the government fit into this? Is it at the regulation where they're doing the regulating of drugs and they've got and changing that? How can the laws protect consumers?
Government is there at every step of the way. Government creates the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office regulations that pass these. Congress passes the regulations for Medicare and in other ways that are very favorable to the pharma industry. Government administers all of these programs. State and federal governments also are in very strong positions as their own buyers. They can turn to the drug companies for all of the drugs that they buy for their hospitals and for the prisoners, for the different employees that they represent, and say, here is what we want, here is what is reasonable. My point is that government has extraordinary power, and your listeners have an opportunity to tell government at all levels what they want to see.
So government has extraordinary power. Why doesn't it wield it? Is this coming down to the pot? Is this where the secret handshakes come in?
It is complicated. It's difficult to break. But I think one of the key things to remember is lobbying. Last year, the pharmaceutical industry as a whole spent nearly $280 million on lobbying. $280 million, an extraordinary amount. Those lobbying efforts were geared slightly more towards Republicans, but that just reflected the current breakdown in Congress.
Right.
Pharma spends lavishly on both parties. It is difficult to push back against power like that.
What about physicians? When you talked about that migraine medicine, if doesn't a physician know that they can prescribe the two separate medications to achieve the same results and save their patients money?
Well, two problems happen with physicians. The first is that the drug companies promote their drugs as the latest and the greatest. Doctors want to help their patients, and the doctor doesn't see the actual price. That price happens when the patient gets a charge standing at the pharmacy. No one knows what those prices are. No one can figure them out ahead of time, not even the patient. So no one really understands how this all flows through. It's deeply hidden, and the pharmaceutical companies protect that information. They guard it like Fort Knox. So information is one problem. Problem number two is that a lot of doctors are benefiting from this system. So when you buy a medication at your doctor's office, or when you have something administered at a doctor's office, whether it's a vaccine or an infusion of some kind, the doctor's getting the same kind of markup and rebate that is happening with other PBM middle players. They make a lot of money off this.
How does that work? And how would a pharmaceutical company know what a doctor is prescribed to me? Isn't that private?
Let's start with what the doctor does in your office. So if you have a vaccine, if you have a shot that a doctor gives you or an infusion, the doctor is buying that medication directly from the pharmaceutical company.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are problems that are much more nefarious in terms of the information and the data mining that is out there and that is available. One of the more interesting class actions I've read recently is an unsealed set of documents about the psychiatric drug Zyprexa. The class action lawsuit suggests that a combined PBM and pharmacy, so CVS Caremark, used data-driven ad targeting to help the company market its Zyprexa drug, presumably in exchange for some form of payments. So the combined pharmacy PBM sent a letter to 120,000 doctors targeted based on the claims information, that is, what the doctors had prescribed, and the letter touted the benefits of the drug company's drug. And it was carefully worded to look like simple information on the benefits of the drug, but it downplayed reports of side effects, pointed to similar side effects in other drugs. In other words, it was trying to persuade the doctors to sell this particular company's drugs. These are the kinds of secret handshakes that don't benefit any of us.
What about advertising in general? Someone remarked the other day to me that they're from another country and they cannot believe the amount of advertising we have for prescription drugs in the United States. It wasn't always that way. It kind of popped up, it seems like, in recent years. Is this related?
I believe direct-to-consumer advertising is a serious problem. There are only two countries I'm aware of that allow it, and that's the United States and New Zealand. That should say something to us about what the rest of the world thinks about our perspective. It is very difficult. Advertisements prey on people's fears, on their weaknesses. It may give them information that they don't have the ability to digest fully, and it can drive utilization towards high drugs or drugs that may high-priced drugs, mm-hmm. or drugs that may have little benefit over something else in the same class.
Is it legal, do we know, to use the cost of advertising to factor in the price of the into the price of the drug?
I am not an accounting expert, mm-hmm. but my understanding would be that all costs of that a company spends flow into the cost of the drug. When the drug companies tell you how much it costs to produce a particular drug, they roll in all kinds of costs, not just the cost of the research and development on this drug. They tend to roll in all of the costs of the research and development on all the drugs they tried and failed.
Mm.
It's a little like saying, gosh, I started a company and it went belly up, so I started a new company, and I'm going to have the consumers in my new company pay for all of my losses the last company.
Boy, so much to talk about and no more time left, Robin Feldman. I really appreciate your time today, though. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to focus on this.
Robin Feldman is a University of California Hastings law professor and author of the forthcoming book, Drugs, Money, and Secret Handshakes, The Unstoppable Growth of Prescription Drug Prices. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If you exercise regularly into your senior years, your muscles and your aerobic capacity could belie your age. That's the conclusion of a Ball State University study of a group of active septuagenarians. The director of the Human Performance Laboratory at Ball State, Scott Trapp, is the lead author of the study. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Our bodies do change as we age, right?
Oh, absolutely. At the end, biology wins, for sure, but exercise can significantly slow that process.
This reminds me of the argument that the authors of Younger Next Year were making about a decade ago.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of data. We know exercise is good for you. I don't think anybody would question that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a big movement into more exercise research to really understand what the true benefits are and quantifying those. And that's really kind of what we're trying to do with this study as well.
And where did you come up with the 30 years younger sort of description?
Oh, it's a combination of things. We took the data that was generated by these people and compared it against a database. And when you actually looked at the achievements that they were able to get in their cardiovascular fitness, it profiled individuals who were 30 to 35 years younger.
They're septuagenarians, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's people in their 70s?
Yeah, and we focused on that age group in particular. You know, this whole idea came about that, you know, looking at the exercise as a hobby took off in the exercise boom in the late 60s and early 1970s, and we know and these people were just getting into their 70s and up to years 80 years old. And the aging literature and performance data clearly shows a big change in your 70s. So we were looking to capture sort of that window because it has a unique window when we begin to change even more rapidly with the aging process.
How did you conduct the study? Who did you talk to? We know that's the age group you talked to, but who?
Oh, it was a wide range of people and personalities. Not only did we have lifelong exercising men and women, we had age-matched older men and women that were non-exercisers. They were healthy. They volunteered. They were active, but they weren't structured exercisers. And then we also had young individuals that had exercise habits at a young age that were comparable to these lifelong exercisers. We interviewed over 400 people, ultimately settling on 72 people that qualified for the study.
And did you take their blood pressure and those kinds of things?
Oh, yeah. We did all sorts of vital clinical assessments with blood pressure and looking at general health markers in the blood and heart health and screening for them to be eligible to, you know, do the types of things we wanted them to participate in for the research.
You expected that the younger people would have had the better muscles and aerobic capacities compared to the older people in the study, but that wasn't the case, right?
Well, you know, we walked into it kind of thinking a good, better, best type thing where the young people would be the best, the lifelong exercisers would be in the middle, and we knew our older, healthy people would still be good, but relatively we thought that, you know, we'd kind of see this tiered approach in a sort of a hierarchical pattern. And we did see that with the aerobic capacity where the younger people had the biggest engine. The lifelong exercisers were in the middle, and they actually looked like they were about 30 years younger, as you highlighted at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But when we looked, we have a special procedure that we do in the laboratory to get a muscle sample about the size of a pea, and we can do all sorts of chemistry with it. And we were looking at two things in particular for this part of the study. One, we were looking at these microvessels or capillaries, and this is where blood flows through the muscle bed. It delivers oxygen, it delivers nutrition to the muscle. And we also look at the enzymes that process these fuels to produce energy and aerobically. And when we looked at those in the lifelong exercisers, the older lifelong exercisers, they were the same as the younger people, which did surprise us that the muscle components were equivalent. We didn't see much aging relative to those markers.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about a Ball State University study that showed that if you exercise regularly into your senior years, your muscles and your aerobic capacity can make you look or feel 30 years younger. My guest is the director of the Human Performance Laboratory at Ball State that conducted the study, Scott Trapp. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Were there any differences when it came to gender?
There were a few things, pretty subtle. You know, generally, most of the benefits we saw tracked the same between the men and the women. You really had to get down in the weeds. A few things were a little different that looked like there might have been some things going on between the genders. But for the most part, the benefits seemed to track very well between the men and the women.
And were they, when you say lifelong, what do you mean by that? Do you mean since childhood or since they were in their 20s or what?
Young adults. They just kind of latched on very young and stayed with it, you know. So, and, you know, we've studied champion athletes in the past that have been quite older, but, you know, they have a little different path in life, if you will. So we were interested in people here that picked it up as a hobby because of the exercise boom, and they had families and careers, and so the exercise was this part they had to sort of do as their hobby on the side. And, you know, there were a few interruptions, more so with the women.
Because of pregnancy, that kind of thing?
Yeah, pregnancies, raising their family, but they still kept with it pretty good. And then what was interesting when you looked in, we had that most of these people kept good log books, and we recorded their exercise and interviewed them. And as their kids moved out of the house and the career sort of slowed down, the exercise picked up even more as they got older. That was because it was their hobby, and when they had time to choose what they wanted to do with it, they ended up choosing to do even more exercise. So as they got older, they got back into exercise even more vigorously.
My recollection of the 60s and 70s when it comes to the exercise boom is that it had revolved largely around running.
That's correct, and most of these people, that was the draw into it. There were some significant events back in that era with the Boston Marathon, with Roberta Gibbs and Catherine Switzer, and then Frank Shorter winning the gold medal in 1972 in the marathon. Those were, you know, big draws into the recreational running boom. Then we had Title IX in 1972, mm-hmm. which was really helped the women's movement as well. So, yeah, it did start off as running. I will say, you know, we did see some of that. The joints didn't hold up necessarily the best on everybody. So mm-hmm. some people switched over to more cycling. It's a little more joint friendly, or a combination. They ran, but maybe they didn't run as much because they supplemented it with other activities, and in this case, particularly cycling.
Hmm. Is there a lot of other research out there like this that you can compare with?
It's starting to happen. I think we were right on the front edge with this because we wanted people in their 70s that started with this exercise boom. So it was really a first opportunity that people were aging into this category. And, we happen to be right on the front edge of this. So I think there'll be more in this area forthcoming in the future, certainly from our team and I think others as well.
As far as people who haven't exercised, you said particularly for women, there have been some blips because of pregnancy, child rearing, that kind of a thing. But does it inform us at all about people who haven't been regular exercisers to get out there and do something that it'll make a difference for them too? Or is it too soon to draw that conclusion?
No, I think, well, this feeds into that. There have been a fair amount of studies. We've done some of those, and there's a lot around the United States and other parts of the world where they've brought people 70s, 80s, even into their 90s, and brought them either through structured aerobic or resistance training and showed some very positive adaptations. So we know the body maintains its ability to adapt no matter what age you are. So if you're on the sidelines, it doesn't matter. If you get into an exercise regime, you will reap some benefits from that. This adds to the point, like, how much can you really benefit if you end up, exercising your entire life? So they complement each other very well, but the body does maintain its ability to adapt to exercise even late into life.
An email from Margaret. She says, hello, I'm 63. I just started working out regularly, but I don't feel that different. How do I know if I'm doing the right things? What should I be doing?
Well, if I could talk to Margaret, I'd ask her what she's doing, first of all, and then the other, I'd say be patient. These things take time. I'd say look at your progress you've made at 6 months or a year. Doing some type of aerobic exercise, brisk walking or cycling or, running, you'd want to be checked by your physician to make sure you could tolerate vigorous exercise, assuming that's the case. It's some type of cardiovascular stress and also some type of resistance exercise. I'd recommend resistance exercise 2 days a week, hitting the major muscle groups. But you want to make sure that it's of good quality. Oftentimes I'll see people get into exercise and they'll soft pedal it, if you will. Sorry for that sort of slang term, but, go too easy and they're expecting the big benefits. So any type of exercise is helpful. And if you can add some quality or vigorous to it, you'll tend to see more benefits from that type of exercise.
Okay. As far as knowing what kind of advice you should get and where do you go for advice, do you just go to your garden variety trainer at the local gym, or should you get something more specific to older adults?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. I'll give you my view on it. I think, if you are on the sidelines and looking to get involved, I think you do need to get cleared by your physician. I think that's the first stop. The second stop is a little bit more difficult. There are a lot of options out there, getting a personal trainer, joining a local fitness club, going to the YMCA, those types of things. I would say the infrastructure for this is a little uneven, right? It's not all personal trainers the same. Maybe not all are educated in, geriatric exercise, geriatric health, or senior health. And I think, finding the right fit, right combination of individual and skill set does take a little bit of effort, but they're out there, and I would explore a lot of these resources to find the right fit.
Is there any news on this score regarding brain health?
We didn't study it directly in this, but I have colleagues who do, and the data is starting to emerge with that, with the types of technologies where they can image the brain. And from what I've seen, the data is quite clear that exercise enhances brain function and cognition as well.
The federal government released a new exercise guidelines for the first time in a decade this month, and they asked schools to keep, young children active throughout the day, every day, and not just in gym class. Is that kind of part of the issue here, is just our overall dynamism in our day?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you look at it as a society, we've kind of engineered most of the work out of our lives because of technology and standard of living. So now we almost have to have structured exercise to engineer it back in, if you will. So, yeah, I think that it's a combination of things.
What's next, Scott Trapp? I mean, what's the next step in your work here?
Well, it's a good question. We're continuing to work on this. We have a lot more work in this with these same subjects that we've been working on, looking at also the genetics of it and the genetic response to exercise. The other thing we're part of, it's a nationwide effort now to look at sort of what the molecular basis is or the genetic basis is the health benefits of exercise. This is a new initiative by the National Institutes of Health. It's $170 million where we're going to be looking at discovering the molecules that really trigger these health benefits for exercise. We're in the planning phase for this right now. We should be launching our first subjects in early 2019, and this will be ongoing for the next 5 or 6 years. So it's a super exciting initiative by the National Institutes of Health to further understand what the health benefits of exercise are.
I mean, could exercise be sort of the fountain of youth?
Well, I think it's the best one we have out there. I mean, you know, there are people trying to, you know, push pharmacology. I was listening. That was your segment before this. And that just can't replicate the far-reaching, you know, broad-range systemic benefits that we get from exercise. So, yeah, I think if there is a fountain of youth out there, exercise certainly right now is the leading candidate.
Well, thank you, Scott Trapp, for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Ann.
Scott Trapp, director of the Human Performance Laboratory at Ball State. They put out a new report from a study that concludes that a group of active septuagenarians live, you know, have bodies equivalent to a 30-year-old. I'm sorry, 30 years younger, I wish. We'll be right back with more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Columbus Public Health is hosting an event tonight to address drug addiction in the African-American community. For more information, you can check out the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now by phone is Columbus Health Commissioner Dr. Mashika Roberts. Dr. Roberts will be a special guest speaker at the event. Welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Good morning. How are you?
Why is this event necessary?
Well, as we know, the opiate crisis has hit every aspect of our community. And I think for the African-American community, they have a feeling that they have been left out of the equation and left out of the conversations. As many people know, in the 80s, when there was crack cocaine epidemics that largely affected inner city minority populations, the African-American population, the way the community at large responded to that drug epidemic is very different than how we're responding to opiates. And the African-American community feels left out, and they want to be included in this process, and they want the same amount of help, and they're dealing with the same issues that all the other communities are dealing with. So this event tonight is an opportunity for us to raise the awareness that the opiate epidemic is impacting the African-American community. It also allows us to address the stigma. We know that the stigma with the opiate epidemic is very significant. And with many things in minority communities, that stigma can be enhanced. It's also an opportunity for us to provide education and resources directly to the community that needs it wants it.
You know, on top of just the physical ramifications of drug addiction, the war on drugs in the 70s that was started affected profoundly the minority communities, African-American communities in our city centers. And I'm wondering how that dynamic then affects your ability to do what you want to do tonight.
I definitely think it has a significant impact and potentially a negative impact because in the 70s and 80s, there was a feeling from the community that no one cared, mm-hmm. and no one in authority cared. And
Except to arrest,
exactly. Mm-hmm. They would be arrested, but they weren't given the help that they needed. And now with, you know, all the information we have learned over decades, we know that that was not the best approach. And the approach that we're trying to provide now to our community members regarding this opiate epidemic is really a comprehensive approach and meeting people where they are and trying to get them into treatment when they're ready for it.
You said that there's an additional stigma. Tell me about that.
Well, I think we all know that there has been a stigma with addiction, and whether it's alcohol addiction, whether it's drug addiction, and specifically if it's opiate addiction. And in the African-American community, we struggle sometimes dealing with stigma. I mean, we've seen that with the HIV epidemic, with the LGBTQ community. And so trying to get over the barriers of the stigma so that we can get to the heart of the issue and help those who need our help is really important for us to all be successful.
In other words, don't judge your child. Help your child get some help.
Absolutely. Don't judge your child. Don't judge your family member. Don't judge your neighbor. Don't judge your friend. Help them get the help they need.
How does Ohio, or Columbus, I should say, stack up with other cities in the state when it comes to addressing this issue? Do you know what other cities are doing?
Well, we know that across the state we have individuals who are dying every single day from the opiate epidemic. Right here in Franklin County, we have about 4,300 active heroin users every day, and we know that two residents die from a heroin or an opiate overdose in our community almost every day. We know that what's concerning to us is for many years when we looked at the rate of opiate overdose deaths in the Caucasian community compared to minority communities like the African-American community, we know that the African-American community was underrepresented. That's starting to change, and that's concerning, that more in the African-American community are dying from opiate overdose than we saw 2 and 3 years ago. And that's despite all the efforts we've made to provide naloxone, to provide education, to provide treatment. And so we have to get to the community, let them know of the resources that are available, and make sure those resources are accessible to everybody.
And are you finding a similar trajectory with law enforcement, that they tend to arrest and charge African-Americans more often or at a higher rate or disproportionate rate than whites?
I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question, but unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that.
And who are you expecting to show up tonight to this event?
Well, we are hoping that we get community members who have been affected by the opiate epidemic, whether they have a loved one who is using or has been using, whether they are a church that wants to do more to help their members, whether they're community leaders. We've had a good response from treatment providers who want to come and share with the community of what treatment options are available for individuals in the community. So really anyone and everyone who's been touched and affected by the opiate epidemic or wants to know more about the opiate epidemic, we want them to come and try to get some answers.
You're going to be one of the speakers. Who are some of the others? You said some of the treatment programs are going to be there speaking. What's the structure going to be like? Is it going to be people lecturing the audience, or how's that going to work?
So we will have a few different speakers come and provide a brief overview of the work they're doing in this arena, in the opiate epidemic, particularly in the African-American community. So we're going to have an ER doctor, Dr. Laura Espy Bell from Ohio Health, who's going to talk about her experience of treating patients in the ER. We're going to have our Franklin County coroner, Dr. Anahi Ortiz, come and talk about, you know, the experience from the coroner's perspective and what individuals might want to anticipate if they were to have a loved one who were to die of an opiate overdose and what that might mean for them. We're going to have one of our treatment providers, a relatively new treatment provider from Arizona Counseling and Consultation Services, Deborah Pounds, come and talk about her services. So I'm hoping that it won't be a lot of lecturing. There definitely will be time for question and answers, for people to ask us questions and concerns that they have. And then we're going to have Cecil Ahad here from Men for the Movement. He was very instrumental in having us set this up. We did do a similar event about 2 years ago, A little, yeah. And so we feel that it's necessary to come back to the community with the new information we have, share it with them, and most importantly, share resources with them.
When you talk about the increase in addiction, opioid addiction in the African American community, is it pretty much across the board like it is sort of writ large in the country right now?
When you say across the board, do you mean in terms of
socioeconomics,
gender?
Yeah.
Absolutely. 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 And, you know, we've got, you know, I went to an event a while ago and there was a gentleman there who had been prescribed Percocet for years for a chronic condition he had. And now because of some of the changes at the state level and how providers can write prescriptions for Percocet, he had really been squeezed out of getting his prescription that he had now grown addicted to by a provider. And he was frustrated because he wasn't getting the assistance he needed from the provider to really find a new drug that could help him or treatment that could help him with his addiction that was, you know, really prescribed to him.
Yeah.
Percocet was prescribed to him. And so that's a common complaint I hear in all communities, not just communities of color, that our providers need to provide that bridge and give them that guidance of how they go from a daily, multiple daily doses of Percocet and knowing that it's restricted in terms of how many pills they can give them to a new medication and, most importantly, treatment for their addiction, identifying it as an addiction.
Is this an obligation of physicians or is there a mandate for that?
In terms of restricting the prescription?
No, I know about the restrictions are part of the mandates and part of these laws that have been passed. But as far as how the physician then responds in prescribing another drug or in addressing the addiction issue in their patients who, through no fault of their own, have become addicted to these prescriptions?
Well, you know, when any person, any physician graduated from med school and decided to be a physician, they took an oath to do no harm. And so in my opinion, that is an obligation they have to their patient to help them get through whatever medical crisis they're dealing with and provide those resources for them. That's my personal opinion.
My guest is Dr. Mashika Roberts. She's the Columbus Health Commissioner. She's going to be one of the speakers tonight at a community event. It's Columbus Public Health is hosting an event tonight to address a drug addiction in the African American community. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Roberts, give us a call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What are the barriers to getting treatment at this point in the African American community?
Yeah, I think some of the obvious barriers is people don't know where to go, who to ask. And then once they might figure that out or they know who to ask, they're concerned of how am I going to pay for it? You know, is insurance going to cover it? Will my insurance cover it? I don't have insurance. Can I get insurance? I think the cost is an issue as well. And then I think it goes back to the stigma. You know, if this is someone who is hiding their addiction in some way, shape, or form, you know, how are they going to explain to their family or their employer that they need to take off or be away for, you know, 2 weeks, 4 weeks to get treatment for a drug addiction?
Mm-hmm.
So that it goes back to the stigma as well.
And what kind of advice do you give people that are in that predicament?
Well, I think they have to first accept the fact that what they have is an addiction, but it's a disease. And like any disease, whether it's diabetes, whether it's cancer, it needs treatment. And you have to take time out to get that treatment. And so this is a disease that they need treatment for, and they should not feel like it's going to label them in a negative and have negative impacts for them in their family situation or their employer, because it is a disease.
A really important piece of this, and you've already talked about it, is the fact that a lot of people get addicted from legally prescribed drugs for genuine conditions, actual conditions that they suffer from. What do people need to know when they're talking with their doctors? What kind of questions can they ask them to better understand? Because I know a lot of people are intimidated by their physicians. They're smart. They got through medical school. I didn't. You intimidate me. You know. So you know what? How can people learn to advocate for themselves?
Well, I think the first thing they need to do is ask the prescribing provider, what are you prescribing? Is it an opiate? And is there something else I can take that is less addicting? And they should start with that question. And hopefully the provider will oblige them by giving them options of what else they can take or prescribe for them to help them with their pain. I think, you know, in 2018, there's been so much information about opiate addiction that many providers have changed their prescribing habits as a result of that. Some of them they had to do, but some of them, you know, we realize now that opiates are addictive. You know, 20 years ago, we were told this was a safe drug and that people wouldn't get addicted to it. And that obviously was not correct. And so with more information, with more research and more data, I believe, and I strongly believe this, that providers have more information. But it's also up to the patient to say, what else can I do? You know, if this is a chronic pain issue, can I do physical therapy? Can I do yoga? There are a lot of different alternative medicines or medications that you can do out there now, other than popping a pill like an opiate.
And are you going to have, are people going to learn about that tonight?
There will be some resources here for that as well. Yes, there will be. We have a resource fair before the event, and there'll be a variety of different vendors there, and some of them are providing the alternative medical services for pain relief.
And this is obviously an event that anybody can go to, right?
Yes, open to the public. Anyone is welcome.
But it sounds like also a great event to go to in a group.
Yeah, you could come as a group, you know, whether you were a community group, a church group. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And where is it going to be at?
So it's going to be right here at Columbus Public Health. We're located at 240 Parsons Avenue. It's going to be in our auditorium on the second floor, and we are on the corner of Parsons and Main, just down the street from Nationwide Children's Hospital.
And free parking?
There is plenty of free parking, yes.
And how many people can you accommodate? How many are you expecting?
We can accommodate in the auditorium about 200 individuals, mm-hmm. and, you know, we're hoping that we get at least 100 tonight.
You said you did this a couple years ago. What did you learn from that that's informing you this time around?
You know, I think one of the main things I learned from that event that we had was the anger and frustration of the African-American community, of how, as a community at large, we responded to the crack epidemic compared to how we're responding to the opiate epidemic. Mm-hmm. And for me, as a leader in the community, I just had to acknowledge what happened in the 70s and 80s was wrong, mm-hmm. and we've learned from that, and we all need to move on and see how we can work together to address this drug epidemic now.
Well, Dr. Mashika Roberts, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Dr. Mashika Roberts is the Columbus Health Commissioner. She will be speaking today at an event to address drug addiction in the African-American community. We'll have more about this at a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for your attention. Have a great day. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.